Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Information about the weekly update podcast on our website. Go to jmnam.org. Check out the news section on the homepage. And you can get all the information about having this segment podcasted for you. He joins us live via telephone Friday mornings here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Boy, did you bum me out. What are you doing here Labor Day weekend? Oh, boy. Right between the eyes.
Well, I know you get paid overtime when you work these Fridays, so I'm sure that was the reason.
Oh, that means Monday will probably be triple pay. All right. Fantastic. Well worth getting up early on Labor Day morning. So here you go, folks. We have a trip to Turkey that Malcolm took this week, but I'm going to start here in the United States because I love getting Malcolm's impressions of these different political conventions over the years. All right, the RNC for this year is now over. Anything earth-shattering that you'd like to share with us that you noticed over the last 3 days?
Well, I was out of the country for with part of it, so I couldn't follow it minute by minute as usually would. But I thought that the candidates came through very strongly, putting forward who they are and what they stand for. Might have wanted more details in terms of policy and other things, but I think that will be coming. What they had to do, they did, you know, with the weather and the other things that sort of mitigated against the beginning of the convention,
right,
and being distractions. I thought they got their footing, and last night the Romney, I thought, did presented himself in a compassionate and passionate way.
Now, if there is, and now I did not, because I was at two weddings last night, thank God. I didn't hear the speech live. I just read the text minutes ago, so rather quickly. But I would bet the one disappointment Malcolm Honlein had regarding last night's speech was not one mention of foreign policy, not one mention of what we've been talking about, especially over the last few weeks, that there's an enemy out there that's ready to act against the West.
Well, he did mention Israel, I think, in the text, in his remarks, and I've talked about the fact that we throw our friends or alienate our friends, and that in his administration, our friends would be, you know, we would reach out and strengthen the relationship with our friends and address the relationship with Putin, said that they would be addressed with some backbone.
But did he mention Iran by name? I didn't find it if he did.
No, I said Israel.
No, I know, but how could you not, as the Republican nominee, mention Iran by name?
Did mention Iran.
Did?
Yeah.
Oh, so I apologize for that. But I don't know. I would think that that you would say a lack of emphasis in that area. In fact, there were rumors flying yesterday during the day among pundits that in the original speech he was not even going to mention anything regarding foreign policy.
You know what? It's a reflection, though, of the fact that foreign policy is marginal in this election,
right,
and generally in terms of people's concerns, and that is at times scary, but it's a reflection, I think, of a realistic assessment of what is really important. He has addressed foreign policy in a lot of his speeches and on the campaign trail, and his allusion to Iran, but I know that the message he was trying to communicate wasn't so much on policy. It was clear to me that his advisors and he agreed that what he had to do was present himself to address the issue of gender,
right,
you know, the alienation of women, the other things that he tried to present. And, you know, now the debates, we'll be able to focus, I think, on more specifics.
Right.
I think they will be very important this time.
Yeah, I apologize for harping on this. Just humor me for another second. But to me, if God forbid something really drastic occurs in this whole arena of what we consider to be, you know, the greatest threat to the West in the next few months, then history, it will be interesting to see how historians will say, my gosh, look at the Republican National Convention of 2012, you know, a few months before, how this whole topic was not nearly the focus it should have been.
Well, first of all, I think that's been the pattern,
right,
for some time,
right,
in both parties. That's one, too. I mean, it's only the beginnings. This is only the opening salvo.
Right.
Like, he hasn't addressed these issues. And he did have, as I said, a couple sentences in there.
Right.
Obviously, I always like to have much more on it and more specifics. But you're absolutely right. In view of the events of this past week regarding Iran with the non-aligned movement, many other things taking place in Tehran, and the new revelations from the Atomic Energy Agency, of course, we would have wanted to see more said.
Right.
But frankly, I want to see more done.
Yeah, understood. The Secretary General heads to Iran, and Malcolm decides to go to Turkey. That was quite a quite an answer to his trip to Iran. We'll get to that. We'll get to all that in a moment. I know it wasn't a direct response, just kidding around. It's my Labor Day sense of humor, Malcolm.
Oh.
You know, the end of summer, it comes through finally. Any Jewish communities directly affected by Hurricane Isaac that contacted your office? Or I mean, I know obviously we're concerned about everybody, but we always take special interest if there is a specific community that you've heard from.
I have not, but I do know that there were some synagogues and others that had taken precautions. I've not heard about any specific damage done to Jewish institutions.
Right, which you probably would have if it would have been to...
it gets very severe, we
right,
hear about it.
Any type of severity. Also, earlier in the week, we spoke to a couple of people at the RNC, and one of them mentioned... excuse me, one of them mentioned this whole concept of foreign leaders getting involved in American elections. We know that President Clinton, I think, was reasonably criticized when he got involved in the Israeli election. I think you'd agree with that. There was a degree of criticism that was certainly legitimate in that case. And this commentator pointed out here that it's something that Bibi would never do. But I just wanted to ask you your opinion. Wouldn't you agree that no Israeli prime minister would ever make that move to get involved in any type of election like this? Not just Bibi?
Well, there is a principle of not being involved in.
Understood.
Certainly inappropriate. But if you remember, there was something, I think, with Nixon or Rabin and Nixon, others that were interpreted as comments that were seen as interference or as semi-endorsement. So I think people since then have been very careful and shy. But you have seen that the Israelis have made comments on both sides of this campaign or made comments that could be interpreted as being favorable towards one side or the other.
Right.
I think that Shimon Peres made comments about President Obama. I know that Romney certainly has played up his friendship and past history with Netanyahu. But I think the healthy thing is for them to all stay out of it. There is a sense in Washington that the Netanyahu government, not Netanyahu himself, seemed to favor Mr. Romney. I think, and in my discussions with the Prime Minister this week, that is not the case. I think they are really trying to play it straight and just focus on the issues and the needs that are so immediate and so urgent.
Well, yeah, I guess Bibi would be taking extra precaution, but I you're right. Too many people involved in the Israeli government, I guess, are saying too much about what's happening here. All right, the visit of Ban Ki-moon to Tehran. So he goes and he chides them for some of the things that that the Iranians have become famous for. Certainly the president in Iran has become well known for, and that's the Holocaust denial, calling for the destruction of Israel. Now, when he goes, issues this criticism, whether at these meetings or in front of the president or not, I can't figure it out, you know, in what context it was said. Is there a response from Iran to the Secretary General?
Well, they were very upset with his comments. It was nothing they could do. For him, it was a coup that he decided to come. People don't know that the Non-Aligned Movement is an association of 120 countries that dates back to the Cold War era, when countries that were neither aligned with Russia or with the U.S., West and East, formed this organization. And it continues under the chairmanship of a different country every 3 years. And Egypt was the chairman till now, which is why Morsi felt the obligation, supposedly, that he had to go, even though he only went for a few hours, which is important. I'll explain that in a minute. And now Iran becomes the chair. And so when they get up in the UN and they do all their diatribes against Jews, Israel, the United States, etc., they're also speaking as chair of the Non-Aligned Movement. And the fact that you had leaders of 120 countries sitting there while they made their horrific comments about destroying the Zionist state, etc., as somebody said, it just shows you how hollow Never Again really is on the international scene. And Bibi called it a disgrace and a stain on humanity. We had tried to convince Ban Ki-moon not to go. He said that in the end he would go, but that he would make comments, which he did. In his comments, he addressed the issues of Holocaust denial, and he criticized the calling for the destruction of another member state of Israel. He made some other comments. but there was a picture that was circulated showing him meeting with Khamenei,
right,
smiling and laughing together.
Right.
And I say, just take out Khamenei's picture and put Hitler, and ask what would be the reaction if in 1942 that picture of the United Nations Secretary General appearing with, well, wasn't there, but right, the equivalent at that time. So the non-aligned movement meeting was significant because it breaks the isolation of Tehran. When you have all these world leaders, I think 40 heads of state came, prime ministers, others. What's also important is who was not there. Contrary to the reports, the king of Saudi Arabia did not go. The prime minister of Turkey, Erdogan, did not go, nor did the foreign minister go attend, which had all been expected, and there was a call for a four-way meeting to deal with Syria, and yet two of the participants did not go, and Morsi left very quickly from the meeting, and the Syrian foreign minister walked out during Morsi's address, the president of Egypt, because he called for the removal of Assad. And that has caused some...
Which we got it. You're going to have to explain to us. But get to my original question for a second. I mean, how does Iran react? Are they embarrassed? Are they angry? Do they ignore it? Do they laugh at it? What happens when the Secretary General makes these statements in front of them?
Well, they were angry that he made the statements, but they knew he would do something of the kind. He had to justify his visit. But for him, for them, the more important thing is that he was there, that he legitimated this illegitimate regime. That is a violator of human rights. He made an allusion to the violation of human rights. But for them, it's the picture that comes out that Ban Ki-moon and all these other heads of state, and as someone pointed out, the presence of Ban Ki-moon enabled others to go.
Right. He brings legitimacy to it, as you described.
Exactly.
All right, so now explain Morsi. Why is he calling for the end of the Assad regime? I would think that they could be, you know, pretty good allies.
Well, first of all, because of the the killings that are going on, and he wants to assert Egypt's role once again as a regional power, also because of the link between Muslim Brotherhood and the people fighting against Assad, who are Muslim Brothers. Each of the countries has their own vested interests and sees this both in local and larger terms. He's also dependent on Saudi Arabia for money. He's looking to others for money and the Sunni Shiite thing. There's so many things that come into play when Morsi makes a comment as he did.
All right, so he feels a kinship. He feels a kinship to those who are rebelling against Assad. That I understand, but he's still. I mean, the only way to project yourself as the leader of the region is to project this peaceful impression. That's what it sounds like. That the only way for Egypt to take on this role under his leadership is if he tries to quell or to encourage the quelling of these tyrannical regimes.
Well, what he's saying is that all the revolutions, including the one in Egypt, were legitimate.
Right.
That this is the direction of the future, and he hopes the same thing is going to happen in Syria.
And that's
it. He wants to see the Muslim Brotherhood emerge in Syria, just as they did across North
right.
Africa.
We had democratic elections in Egypt, and now I encourage the same thing to happen over there.
But also the emergence, or anticipates the emergence. There are now three groups leading the opposition. One is Muslim Brotherhood, supported by Qatar and by Saudi Arabia and others. Then you have the Al-Qaeda, mm-hmm, with backing from Iraq and others, and Iran. And then you have the local regional leaders, who are essentially, so most of them are fundamentalists as well. They hold control over specific areas. They're not all unified. There's no common identity amongst the groups. There's no common ideology amongst the groups, but you could see a coalescence of, let's say, Group 1 and Group 2, which could then take dominance in the opposition and in whatever follows. All of the parties want to have a say in what emerges. That includes Saudi Arabia, that includes Turkey, that includes Iran, that includes Egypt. Everybody wants to have a say, Lebanon, in what will emerge post-Assad. They all have vested interests in it. Mm. And, of course, it will have a big say. So Iran continues to be willing to play a role because they want to make sure that they can protect their interests.
Right. And when it comes to Egypt, then you could say the next regime in Syria is much more important to Morsi than the current regime.
That's right. There's it.
Simple as that. By the way, we'll give you a chance to take a little drink of water with that throat problem you're having over there. I still recommend to you the Kyolic, Malcolm. You never know the magic of garlic. It could solve things in a moment.
Yeah, that'll be
it's America's one and only. That's right, folks. I give medical advice as well. America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Information about the Malcolm Honlein Weekly Update podcast, go to our website, jmnam.org. Check out the news section. The information is there. Join us Tuesday morning when we announce the expansion of our jmnam.org online network. And that'll happen at 35 West 36th Street in New York City. Starting at 6 a.m. at the Jerusalem Cafe, you are all invited. All right, Malcolm, why go to Turkey this week? You told me off the air it was just a half a day trip. Why was it worth your time to head over to Turkey this week?
Well, I went to Israel for a day and on my way visited Turkey to meet with some important personalities there, not with Erdogan and not with the current government, with whom I do not meet, but also to meet with the leaders of the Jewish community. And it's truly a remarkable community despite all the tremendous pressure they're under. It's a very old community, so you know.
What city?
Istanbul.
Mm-hmm.
And the they have kosher restaurants, they have some kosher facilities there. They have many functioning synagogues and Jewish schools. The community has diminished over the years from the time that it was one time considered the Constantinople was the largest Jewish community in the Middle Ages, I think, the largest single community. Its population swelled after 1492, and many Jews from Spain found refuge in the Ottoman Empire in Turkey. So the community itself is is under strain, but they are very courageous, very upbeat in terms of the continued continuity of the community, the commitments, and we went to have a chance to talk to them about some of the issues and to also meet with some important individuals in Turkey who have views different than that of the ruling elite there, Mr. Erdogan and Davutoglu and others.
So how would you, I mean, I know it's sometimes ridiculous to play this comparison game, but it's not as, it's not flourishing like the Moroccan Jewish communities you told us about, correct? It's not like that, correct?
It's similar because both are under similar pressures. Both.
Even with Turkey's new attitude toward Israel?
Pardon me?
Even with Turkey's new attitude toward Israel? They don't feel more uncomfortable there?
They do. They do feel more uncomfortable from the days when Turkey was one of the key allies.
Right.
But there is also a strong undercurrent of people wanting to see the relationship reestablished. I'm talking about not within the Jewish community.
Right.
Of course that's true, but I'm talking about the general populace.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Mavi Marmara issue is still the major obstacle because they're still demanding a full apology from Israel for what happened.
Unbelievable.
And Israel will not give a full apology, although everybody's trying to work on formula to get everybody to be able to climb down. And it's interesting that despite all of the harsh rhetoric and the curses being that we've heard from Erdogan and Davutoglu, trade between Israel and Turkey is shooting up. Both ways. It's like $2.5 billion now or more. And but when you go in the streets and you travel around, there are similarities to Morocco.
You know, Israel has made apologetic concessions on a lot of, more serious episodes than this one. Like, it's funny that they're taking the hard line.
You have to understand, Nachum, there are real implications. An apology can open up an assuming responsibility. Number one, when you have a terrorist group like IHI, which was responsible for this, actually Turkey should be the one apologizing for allowing them to set sail, for allowing this group to continue to function and use Turkey as a base. That the implications, though, for lawsuits, for everything, would be very great. This is not just the simple question of whether you say you're sorry that these guys died. Israel has said it. But the investigations have all shown, and the Palmer report by the United Nations has shown that Israel was not culpable.
Right. Good point. We saw how long the Corey case stayed in the news. What is it?
That's
like?
Important. And you saw this week. This is a very important case, and people don't understand why it's so significant that after four investigations, after now a lengthy court case, and the parents keep we understand that they lost a child, but keep trying to shift the onus onto Israel, rather than the fact that their daughter was purposely instigating, purposely trying to put herself in danger, has repeatedly been involved in these kind of provocative acts, that the organization she was associated with, the ISM, International Solidarity Movement, is a terrorist supporting organization, has helped finance terrorist groups and try to raise money and support, and that they play havoc with the Israeli military exercises and stuff and put themselves specifically in danger. And in this case, the driver of the tractor could not see her. It was not deliberate. It was not his fault. It was her fault. And those who sent her there deliberately to be provocative. And I hope that people will remind everyone that all the condemnations, you know, the films and the plays about Rachel Corrie, the worldwide campaigns that are ongoing and will continue, despite the facts coming out, despite the findings of a neutral court, and I think everybody agrees that Israeli courts are very neutral. Usually they come down against Israel, in fact, that the ruling this week is of great significance. And yet, right away, it just becomes an opportunity to regurgitate all of the charges without showing that there were four independent investigations all come to the same conclusion.
So that was an Israeli court this week that decided that the lawsuit could not continue?
Yes. But the American government said they will continue to stand by the parents and continue to assist them and help them. It's time to say no more. You did it. We helped you. You had a fair hearing. It's over.
No, you're right. That's a great example of what could happen with this whole Turkey situation if Israel would, in fact, assume culpability. No question about it.
And Israel's willing to go very far in regard to Turkey. And they have made statements. And they've made offers of compensation, other things. But Turkey is not so much interested in the apology. Maybe now, if they feel more pressure and understand that it will be in their interest, maybe then they will be able to come to some formula.
Right. There's a report, by the way, that just a few hours ago, a rocket landed in Sderot. No injuries, thank God. And I bring this up while I also ask you if, in fact, based on our conversation last Friday, have some of those Egyptian tanks left the Sinai or not?
This is a very important issue. I discussed it with the Prime Minister at length because of obviously this has to do with the United States as well, which was the guarantor of the Egyptian-Israeli peace agreement. And the agreement says that they cannot bring these tanks and forces in without permission of Israel. Israel has given them a two-week deadline to get them out. Egyptians indicate that they're not taking them out. They say that they're there to fight terror, but there's no indication that, in fact, these tanks are being used to fight terrorists, and you don't need tanks to fight terrorists in the Sinai. You need to send in troops. You need to land them there. You need to take action that really targets these various terrorist groups. And the fact is that they're doing very little in the Sinai to fight terrorism. So it's very important that the United States Congress, the administration, and others put pressure on Egypt, and the United States government has called on them to honor the agreements, that they withdraw their tanks, and that the presence of 400 tanks on Israel's border under an Islamist government has to send chills down the Prime Minister's back. So it's not just a question that they can have the troops there and that Israel is being finicky about the numbers and agreements. This is a gross violation and ultimately could pose a danger.
It's amazing how this is now, with everything going on, and we bring this up every week about the list of stuff the Prime Minister has to deal with, this is essentially becoming priority one now. And this is one of the most volatile situations that Israel is facing.
Well, when issues number one, two, and three for the Prime Minister are Iran, and the announcements this week that they have doubled the amount of enriched uranium, of underground nuclear centrifuges that are operating in Fordo.
Yeah, big articles about it this week.
From over 1,000 to over 2,000. The fact that the stockpile is up 30% just since May, that is the red line. We have to say now, where is the red line? 250 kilograms is a bomb. They now say they have 190 kilograms of high-grade enriched uranium, up from 145 in May. Where is the red line? Is it at 200? Is it 220? Is it 249? There has to be a clearer message. They've been removing the fences and the grounds and trees and everything around the Parchin base, which is a military installation where we believe they were doing testing and other aspects of the nuclear weapons program. And satellite photos show that they removed all the top the soil and they're trying to cleanse the place. And it was believed that they would invite the members of the NAM to come there. In the end, they did not. but they are expanding all the time their capacity, and the IEA, this is not Israel's figures, this is the International Atomic Energy Agency, raising the red flag, saying how fast this growth is taking place. And we know that there are more and more ways that Iran is bypassing the sanctions through Ecuadorian banks. This week we're exposed Chinese banks, who are now found to be flaunting the law and the restrictions and the sanctions. And I think that this is the developments of this week really raise the stakes a great deal.
I wonder if that will, because we're now, what, 3 weeks away from the big UN meeting? I wonder if it'll call for more sanctions at that point. Could the time?
The problem is that China and Russia will veto anything they try.
China didn't violate understandings with the U.S. this week. They violated UN rules.
No, also understandings with the U.S. because, you know, we've waived the sanctions for them and many other countries who supposedly were in compliance and had reduced their purchases. And in the meantime, they're investing more and more money in Iran and with Iran. The leader of India came to this meeting of the non-aligned. They have increased their trade with Iran substantially. So it's very serious.
You agree with this or not? Vice Premier Moshe Yaalon said today that he feared Iran did not believe it faced a real military threat from the outside world because of mixed messages from foreign powers, including the United States. We have an exchange of views, including with our friends in the U.S., who, in our opinion, are in part responsible for this feeling in Iran. Is the public attitude, different governments, obviously led by the U.S., is that attitude toward Israel and the wishy-washy approach to whether there should be military action against Iran really making Iran think that there's no real military threat against them?
I think that this is a factor, and it's not just the failure of the West to communicate the sense of urgency and determination, and including the United States, but also Israelis, leaders who send conflicting messages and saying, we have the capability, we don't have the capability, we can do it tomorrow, we can't do it for another year, we don't need to do it right away, we have to do it right away. Those kind of messages, if they're meant to keep Iran off guard, they're very successful. But the problem is that you also send mixed signals, and I think that there has to be a much more determined presentation by the West, the unified West, led by the U.S., that really makes a credible military threat. I think that they believe that Israel may do it. I'm not sure they're convinced that Israel has the capability to do it. But the build-up in Hamas, of Hezbollah, and other places, the events in Syria, there are so many factors that, you know, shape and determine what will happen. You can't ever take off the focus, because anytime Iran believes that everybody's distracted, the fact that for these many months, all the discussions, all the P5 plus one talks, all of the other threats, in the meantime, they've been moving ahead. That's why the IAEA report is so important, to bring home a message that we've tried to tell everybody for so long, that all the time we're talking, they're building. And it is because they don't believe, and they want to get to the point where they can finally say, hey, guys, it's too late.
Yeah. You see, my naivete leads me to believe that the timing is fantastic, because suddenly, as you see from all these major news sources, including this big Times article about Israel being in a box because of the Iran nuclear work, it seems like it's really hitting the media finally, and the UN is convening, you know, in a relatively very short time. To me, again, through naivete, it looks like it's the best of both worlds, that finally it's going to be addressed. But based on what you're saying, we're simply going to get past this UN meeting and not much is going to be accomplished in this area.
I don't anticipate that much will happen during the upcoming UN General Assembly opening. And Netanyahu is going to come. He's going to give a speech about Iran. He's going to try and put the markers down. For Israel, the window closes soon.
Yeah.
And Dempsey, the chief of staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, also said recently, acknowledged that Israel's needs are different than the United States, and the window of opportunity for them is much more narrow than for the United States. I am sure that Iran will be an issue, and I think the administration will press countries for more sanctions and for more of an investment. But the point is that sanctions at some point have to be shown they don't work. Negotiations have to be shown not to work. That there has to be something else. There has to be interim steps. I'm not saying an all-out war, and that is certainly the last resort. But until the Iranians honestly believe that that is possible, and we know that every time you confront them and you do it realistically, they back off. And that's why the NAM meeting, which gave them international credibility, and they can point to the world and they say, we're isolated. Here are 120 countries are here. 40 heads of state, some kings, some prime ministers, all were here made their and showed their allegiance to Iran. So, you know, people get distracted. You see all the attention that is given to Arafat's underwear and the investigation, which the French now finally are doing. And, you know, the attention to whether Israel poisoned him or Israel didn't poison. I mean, why would Israel poison him? They could have killed him 1,000 times. They had him in the gun sights in the height of his power. Why would they do something like this afterwards and let him go to Paris to be treated, because they didn't want ever that the accusation be made that they did anything that undermined his health? So you see the quickness with which people get diverted and take on an issue of such marginal significance. And yet these critical issues get almost no attention, and people get tired of it, and they read it, and they say, yes, I read about it yesterday, I read about it before, you know, I heard about it. That's not the issue. This is the critical issue today. We see also in the Palestinians that now it looks like they won't go with unilateral declaration, but they will declare that they're going to move ahead with it, but only after the election, and it's probably a promise they made to the administration that they would not do anything.
Right, similar to what they said last year, right?
Right. But no, but now they have a deadline of an election and said that after the election,
so the second
they will not go to the Security Council, to the General Assembly.
So they're basically telling the world that once November passes, we're going full steam ahead, right? At least that's what they say now. You can't always trust them on their word, you know.
Absolutely.
Finally, Malcolm, you saw this, that there's a demand to ban the Israeli dance company from performing in Scotland. I think it's important to bring up, because sometimes as we sit in the lap of luxury in this very unusual area of the world, in a very unusual era of time for the Jewish world in this country, which is pretty amazing. I think we have to remember that there are many challenges going on around the globe. And, of course, this is simply politics dressed up in arts and leisure, correct?
Absolutely right, and well put. And it's more than that. It is a worldwide effort to try and boycott on cultural entertainment, other sectors, unions, the two British unions, just took some really horrific actions. And the government of South Africa has now what they call tagging.
We mentioned that last week.
Tag Israeli product.
Right.
So that in stores and stuff. And again, people say, well, it has a big difference. It is an unacceptable measure, and especially from a country that suffered from apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that should have been more sensitive and unfortunately, the Jewish community there, which is very upset, and we're in constant touch with them about this, we have to think about what other steps could be taken. But they can't just let these things pass and sort of become acceptable. But this tagging, you know, it's really remarkable. When I was in Turkey and people raised the Rachel Corrie case, and I said, well, do you know about the ruling in this stuff? And they said, no, what ruling? What ruling? And I told him, and he told me that he held up her picture, this official, and I said, but you know who she is? I said, if I held up a picture of somebody from the PKK, which is I mean, they were taken shocked by the whole thing. But you have, every time, you know, that you confront people with facts and you talk to them, this is why people have to be educated and have to know what to argue. It's not, you know, to scream things. It is to make a case. People then change. They become receptive. They see that you know what you're talking about, and you can convince people. It means starts with our own elected officials, and it means reaching out to people wherever they are. You know, we see all the criticism of Israel about Gaza and the continuing criticism about the humanitarian crisis. There was a report this week. There are 600 millionaires in Gaza.
Wow.
600 identified millionaires, which means there are many more. And they make the fortunes from the tunnels, including their people, etc.
Oh, I was going to say there'll be some fundraisers in Gaza soon.
Well, no, but there are a bunch of shalachim on their way already.
Exactly. But it's a good point you're making. Wow. Who would have guessed that?
That's the truth. And that's the story that doesn't get out. And people don't look at that, and then they keep beating up on Israel about all the humanitarian crisis, the tragedy, you know, and all of that. So
that's the way it is. All right. We will reconvene next Friday, I assume.
God willing.
Have a wonderful shot. Rest that voice, please. Malcolm Hohnlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.